Hey there, and welcome back to Crypto Clarified. This is the podcast series where we clarify crypto. It's in the name, it's pretty obvious, but what we actually do in practice is take the most captivating headlines and trends in the crypto space, we break them down, explain what's going on, and ultimately we hope to help you understand better what is a complex and fast-moving space. My name is Benjamin Dean, and I'm a director in WisdomTree's digital assets team. Today, I've got the pleasure of being joined by Diogo Monica, who's a founder at Anchorage Digital. On this show, we're going to talk about a lot of different topics, but I bet you a lot of it's security. We share that as a background, but I'll leave Diogo to introduce himself later. We're going to talk about kind of the last couple of years in what people call crypto, which is, you know, we can unpack that a little bit, but security failures in the past and their consequences we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about how those problems are being solved today and some of the challenges in doing that. Cybersecurity is also a fast-moving and complex space, so we've got plenty of work to do and plenty to talk about. We'll close up by talking about the future, as always, because we love the future. Super interesting. Before we start, US listeners, check out wisdomtreeprime.com on the Apple or Android app stores. Hit subscribe and share. Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, wherever you get podcasts, subscribe, make your life easier. And you can find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. Before we kick off, brace yourselves, people. This is the most thrilling part of the episode. Sam and James in compliance. Here comes the disclaimer. Before I begin, I need to state the following to clarify the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and Anchorage Digital and are subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. All right, on to the fun stuff. Diogo, welcome. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me. And that was a fantastic disclaimer.
Oh, it's thrilling stuff. Super important. Everyone loves it. We do a whole episode of disclaimers, really. It's that thrilling. But I appreciate, you know, your compliment there. I've had plenty of practice complying here at WisdomTree. To kick off the episode, how about you tell folks a little bit about yourself and how you ended up working on Anchorage?
Sounds good. I mean, the short of it is I was born in the US, but I grew up in Portugal. I did a bachelor's, master's, and then a PhD in something that 15 years ago was not very useful, which was distributed systems. And now all of crypto is distributed systems. And so my PhD thesis is on security, distributed systems. And I ended up being an early employee at a company called Square that flew me out of Lisbon in 2011. That's actually where I met my now co-founder almost 14 years ago, Nathan. We joined the same week at Square. And so we, for 4 years together, led the security team at Square, basically protecting credit cards and hundreds of billions of dollars of GPV on a yearly basis. Then we actually did something really cool, which is we moved together to a company called Docker, which a lot of the developers listening are very likely to know, which runs on every single cloud provider in the world. And we led the security team there, added a lot of security to the base platform itself. And then that brings us to 2017, when through the ICO boom, lots of these crypto funds started reaching out to me personally for help with protecting crypto assets, which were essentially private keys that were worth a lot of money. That had never happened in security up until that point. And so there was a fund specifically that came to me that had lost the passphrase to a $1.5 million Bitcoin wallet and offered me 20% if I could break it to it. And so that was effectively the, well, welcome to, you know, a very clear need from the industry. And so started doing consulting until decided that this was a real business. And that's where Anchorage Digital came to be. Through the labor of like two security engineers that actually were working together day in and day out for 7 years and have been working together on this for now six. So it's been a long journey. And I still stand to the point where I think we're the only custodian ever to have been started by two security engineers. And you'd expect a lot more of those to actually exist. Exchanges, custodians, centralized platforms, CeFi, but it's very rare.
All right. We share something in common here, cybersecurity. I didn't spend quite as long as you. I spent 10 years before coming to WisdomTree working on cybersecurity. It's a fascinating set of interlocking problems that change over time. It's true that like back then, I used to work on things like data breaches and ransomware and stuff like that. And you'd have to go and explain to people like, do you understand like how to lock these systems down and how big a problem it is if you don't? And tons of companies kind of turn a blind eye to it. And then they get hacked, inverted commas. So all the data walks out the door or the systems get trashed. And then they've got a big problem on their hands. Thing was, it usually would take time for them to realize it and then tally the cost up with consultants afterwards. You just mentioned then, like in this crypto space, it's essentially private key protection. And we can talk a bit about that later. But the thing that jumped out at me and ended up dragging me into the space is how quickly people realize something's gone wrong. Like it's massive target. So there's plenty of people trying to break in to steal the keys. And then once they've got them, like the stakes are really high and very evident very quickly. So I totally understand why.
It's the world's largest honeypot. It is the only way to describe it. It's really what it is. Bitcoin has been, since the beginning, the world's largest honeypot. And to a certain extent, that's how we know that these technologies are validated and have tons of proof points. And that was actually the basis of it. You know, at the end of the day, this is a cybersecurity company. What we do is we protect private keys. Yes, they are financial instruments. And that's actually part of the reason why we became and are still the first and only federally chartered bank. So we're actually a bank. We have the regulatory apparatus that allows us to custody these assets in a safe manner. But ultimately, the security of the assets themselves doesn't necessarily come from the charter. It comes from obviously the trappings of the charter, the audits from the OCC, all of these things that are great hygiene. But the security itself ultimately comes from the technology that protects the private keys. And this industry, I think to your point, has been interesting because over the past 15 years, let's say, of crypto, a little bit under that since Bitcoin was launched, what we've had is a compressed timeline of the same history that the internet has gone from a security perspective, but compressed within the past 13, 14 years. That's what's actually happened. And you can actually trace this all the way back to nobody was doing crypto. And so everybody that was coming into crypto and was building the initial infrastructure were just normal developers, not security conscious developers, not even security engineers. They're just normal web devs building an exchange. In this case, Mt. Gox was the first one really that came in. And we remember how that ended, right?
Tell the listeners though, you and I remember being OGs, but explain a little bit, unpack it a bit for the listeners. Like what were the security problems that led to the Mt. Gox exchange, a very big early Bitcoin exchange? And then we'll contrast it with other exchanges and how they've been hacked over time.
Yeah. Okay. So it's easy to sit in 2023 and look at the great exchanges and the great custodians out there and kind of like, oh, this has always been like this, but you're right. It really wasn't. And when Bitcoin started out, of course, Bitcoin is a decentralized cryptocurrency and the nodes actually speak to each other. Bitcoin nodes speak to each other via peer-to-peer. So they don't actually require any centralized infrastructure. That was part of the ethos and it still is. And it was one of the core elements of Bitcoin. However, for you and I and just normal retail and individuals to actually access this, the only way for them to actually acquire Bitcoin was through mining originally. And so essentially what ended up happening is people started selling Bitcoin to one another peer-to-peer, but that wasn't efficient. So people started creating websites effectively that allowed them to initially marketplaces, but then later on these kind of what we call now an exchange, the ability of trading back and forth between cryptocurrency and fiat. And Mt. Gox was really the first exchange of Bitcoin, the first centralized exchange that really gained notoriety. And it was just a web developer. It came really from a Magic the Gathering trading cards. That's kind of like where it came, Mt. Gox, the name itself. And then it started taking Bitcoin as a payment mechanism and realized that that was actually the product market fit was the Bitcoin component. And then it got sold to someone that then started managing them or mismanaging it, really. And essentially, the technology was very traditionally vulnerable technology. If I recall correctly, it was PHP and just traditional things that were being hacked left and right at the time, very easy web hacks. And not only that, it not just got hacked, the technology itself, it was having private keys in memory on the servers. So completely exposed private keys on these just computers. And then it actually had a bug where it was possible to siphon off Bitcoin from the actual application. And so even though a hack would have given you the private keys themselves and the ability to steal all of the crypto, it was easier bugs to exploit than actually full compromise. And so it really just went down in tears. Lots of people lost lots of money. It was the first big hack in crypto. And it really created a winter by itself. There was a crypto winter that was derived of the Mt. Gox failure and the exchange hack. So that was actually pretty interesting history. The fun part is that the next wave of cryptocurrency exchanges that came weren't much better because the same types of problems existed. And so they follow the same types of technologies. They still use online private keys, which were very exposed. And then we had the same pain over and over and over again until very recently. And so that's kind of interesting how the original conceptualization of like Mt. Gox and how far we've come, but how these mistakes are actually done over and over again.
Yep. So let's start parsing it out a little bit, because you just talked about, like, you know, you have these cybersecurity problems at an exchange. Someone goes and exploits them in what I call the most adversarial software environment that's out there, outside of maybe the military. And so there's that piece. Me being at WisdomTree, traditional financial service provider, there's all these best practices in finance about what you should and shouldn't do to sustainably and legally run financial service company. Let's contrast Mt. Gox and the cybersecurity failures with something like FTX, and talk a little bit about what went wrong there, how they're different. They did have some cybersecurity issues, but then they also had like some asset segregation, back-end accounting. How are they different, just for the listeners to kind of conceptually understand?
Of course. So maybe let me just give you a little bit of history. So in the beginning, there was, of crypto exchanges, there was no security. Nobody cared about it. It was not something that people cared about. Bitcoin was worth basically nothing. So there was just no security. No thought was put into security. Then later on, people started getting very paranoid, and they started doing what we call cold storage. Cold storage is what I lovingly call pirate custody. It is the same technology that the pirates used in the 1700s to protect their gold coins. They had, you know, these big chests where they put the gold, and they would bury them in an island somewhere, and they would have a map on how to recover it. Except though, what we did was pieces of paper or pieces of metal with private keys or USB keys, and we would put them in safe deposit boxes, and then it would be offline, and there'd be armed guards, and then we would do kind of like a little to-do list on a sequence of steps of how to actually recover them. But that was the same thing. It was pirate custody. That's how we started. But then we realized, wait a minute, we can't really do this because that's incredibly, incredibly cumbersome and slow. And so if you're an exchange or you're trading fast, what you need is you need to have some at least Bitcoin available. So we created these two segregated types of custody systems. We call them hot wallets and cold wallets. Cold wallets are these offline components that or offline systems that are completely offline in safe deposit box. And hot wallet is basically the prior irresponsible, the way that we did for everything in Mt. Gox, which is online wallets, it's on a server. But for now, we will only have a certain percentage of the wallet. So if you get hacked, only a certain percentage of your assets actually get hacked. Most recently, we've gone all the way to actually the use of like good cryptography, hardware security modules, keys in hardware, always in hardware, the use of enclaves, the use of multi-party computation, the use of more sophisticated techniques that actually allow us to make sure that the hot wallets aren't as hot and the cold wallets aren't as cold, in the sense that what we've built, for example, at Anchorage is really cold wallet security, offline, completely air-gapped, but you can access it in minutes. And so it's a little bit of the best of both worlds. It won't do for millisecond type of transactions, but blockchain and blocks in Bitcoin are 10 minutes. And so we're way, way, way faster than the blocks. And so it actually is great for very large institutions to store their crypto all in cold storage, so all offline without the trade-off of liquidity. And that's kind of like the viewpoint of like how we began and where we went to. Now, there's an orthogonal dimension that you mentioned, which is not just the technical security of the exchange and just your controls and security controls that you have, and are you hacked or are you not hacked, but really who's running it. At the end of the day, you not only have to build a system that resists against external adversaries, but you also have to build a system that resists against internal adversaries. We actually do that at Anchorage Digital. What we do is actually, I don't have access to our clients' funds, and you need quorums to do any kind of sensitive operation. That is the reasonable way of running. FTX had multiple sets of failures. They had failures on the cybersecurity side, which they got hacked. Somebody hacked into their actual exchange. They used a vulnerability, and then they were able to siphon off funds from their hot wallets. That happened. That's a typical one. But the big issue with FTX was really that internally, they had the ability of unilaterally doing whatever they wanted. So single individuals were able to change the ledgers, abscond funds, effectively like move them around without any kind of proper procedure, and just, you know, reuse the funds for things that they were not purposefully built for. So is this a hack? Is this a technical issue? Well, it's not necessarily a technical issue. It's an organizational issue, but organizations should be building technology that don't allow them to do this in the first place. And then you also have to have CEOs that are not criminals, right? So that also kind of like doesn't help there. That's effectively what ends up happening, right? It's the organizational issue in that case was a lot bigger than the technical issue.
Now, I'd like to, your analogy before, as the listeners know, I love history. pirate chest of gold, the one that I use sometimes to explain cold storage and the organizational practices one has to put in place to ensure that the cold storage works, is nuclear missile silos. So if you want to launch a nuke, you have to get the code, you have to have several people turn the keys, and then you don't have rogue nukes.
Simultaneously, right? The keys have to be turned simultaneously. That's right.
So it's if you map that set of concepts on here to what you've just said about FTX, it's like, well, they didn't even have the thing that sends the code through. Like, someone could just go and turn one key and take it.
That's exactly
right. But in
right.
an ideal world, you've got a set of organizational kind of procedures and measures in place to ensure the technology isn't misused and abused. And the other one you say is like on the inside versus the outside. Like, that's the reason you have the internal set of keys for a missile silo. You're not worried about people outside necessarily. You're worried about rogue contractors and spies, really.
That's right. And by the way, you talked about regulation in WisdomTree itself. It's one of the key points here is that regulation actually helps with the organizational aspects of this. They audit your business continuity plans. They audit what your organizational charts are, who reports to whom, independence, controls, they have SOCs. So all of those things that we've gotten, SOC 1, SOC 2, the insurance, the actual federal charter that we have that is audited by the oldest banking regulator in the US, the OCC, they validate all these aspects, these organizational aspects, which is one of the biggest helps. I think it's fair to say that from a cybersecurity perspective, what you're betting on is that, you know, the security engineers that have built security for Docker, they've built security for Square alongside a great team of people and cryptographers can actually do a really, really good job. And the regulators can't really introspect at that level, but the regulators can definitely solve and help a lot with regular auditing of the organizational elements so that you can't abscond funds, so that you actually have reports that are correct, so that these accounts actually can't be commingled, all of those aspects that are the human aspects of running organizations.
Yeah. And as we see, you know, a lot of people, some people say to me, they should regulate crypto more. And I say, so what do you mean? And what you kind of identified there is that there are a lot of kind of organizations in different jurisdictions going about their kind of business, not subject to the kind of regulatory requirements that one would have to abide by in certain jurisdictions like the United States. And what we're seeing now is the application of those kind of best practices at the cybersecurity and operational level. And then we're seeing application of the regulations from traditional financial services to those operations. And what I'm starting to see, and this is very different to 2, 5, or 10 years ago, starting to see now almost like an institutionalization or professionalization of the industry that just wasn't there before. It should end in a net benefit, really, because people can use this very efficient, cheap, transparent, global infrastructure, but then have providers to help them do that and not fall into the pitfalls that so many people have fallen into over the past decade.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that the professionalization was forced, right? It's survival of the fittest. Everybody else kind of like went bankrupt, and we see it, right? Anchorage has been, I guess the best description of it is a flight to safety, or, you know, in our case, winning a bigger portion of a smaller pie. The crypto pie is reduced, but Anchorage is winning all of the big players and all the big clients, because who else is there? There's nobody else with a bank charter. Everybody's being sued by the SEC or suing the SEC. All these other people went bankrupt. And so it's just, you know, graded on a curve is A++, right? It's kind of an interesting viewpoint over this, which is it's really survival of the fittest. And crypto, as you described, is one of the most, if not the most adversarial way and system that you can create a company in, because of all the volatility, because of all the regulatory scrutiny, because of all the hacks. And so, you know, it's entrepreneurship in hard mode.
Let's take kind of pivot the discussion, but it's almost a segue. So you said survival of the fittest, and one of the kind of dynamics of this space that I've always found fascinating is to watch new ideas emerge. New ideas compete against one another, and then over time we find out which ones are good, sustainable ideas and which ones are not. Now, there's a segment of the crypto space that some people call decentralized finance or DeFi. They're a set of smart contracts or code that are posted on distributed systems, blockchains. And I remember back in 2016, 2017, a lot of people who raised ICOs would use those funds to build these DeFi apps. And so I've seen the whole kind of story play out up until now of where these DeFi apps emerge. Some of them work, some of them don't, but there's a cybersecurity angle to that as well. Do you want to run the listeners through a little bit, like how the failures of DeFi apps, they're very different to kind of the key management problems we started the show with.
Yeah. So maybe let me start with the advantages. So DeFi, obviously decentralized finance, the ability of having an alternative financial system that is actually built on chain with smart contracts, it has tons of advantages. And we actually saw it with the failure of CeFi lenders, where people actually lost their funds. DeFi actually stood the test of time. And these DeFi protocols did exactly what they were supposed to. And,
this is back during FTX, right?
That's right. That's right. Back during FTX, the compounds, the Aave's, all these protocols operated exactly as they should, even through crazy volatility in a way that was actually very robust, a lot more robust than the traditional financial systems would be. And CeFi in crypto was basically traditional financial infrastructure, but maybe without as much oversight. And so it actually like failed miserably. So that comparison is very interesting to make, because DeFi definitely served its purpose and it has all these advantages. However, it does work in a very adversarial environment. It works on the open internet, and it is done with immutable smart contracts in large part. And that means that anybody can inspect the code. And so to a large extent, the traditional financial system actually works a lot with security through obscurity, where a lot of things are bad, but we just can't really easily access it and see it. And so they don't get hacked as often. And so it extends the period that these things get found a lot larger. In crypto, there's no way to hide it. You have the smart contract, you can see the bugs, and they're going to be immediately exploited as soon as it's as you can monetize it. And so it really is in hard mode, everything in hard mode. And these experiments fail on their face all the time. Now, does it always have to be this way? I think the answer is no. And maybe let me just say that I think this is actually one of a few critical points that is stopping DeFi from truly gaining mainstream adoption and from truly becoming the what we actually want it to be, which is we can't have these hacks continue. It is existential threat to the industry. And there's lots of things that we've done from the beginning wrong. We have used smart contract languages like Solidity, which are crap from a point of view of security. They allow you to shoot yourself in the foot. They're just like bad languages in general. But now we now have better languages like Move that actually allow you to do a lot better smart contract writing, allows you to have provable systems. There's all these new tools that are being used. Unfortunately, the tool in Solidity that gained the most popularity remains, and the majority of the smart contracts are still done in this language. So it's almost like exactly like I said about security in the traditional world, right? We're learning the same things in a compressed amount of time. We had C for a long time. All the buffer overflows came from C. All of the exploits came from C. We still hack these systems because they're running C code, and we already have Golang, we already have Rust, we already have something better. We just really haven't migrated and adopted it because the effects, the network effects of a language are so strong that people that know that language continue doing it. Same exact thing in crypto, compressed in a big timeline. We already have solutions, we already have way better languages, but we're still like operating on Solidity and some of these smart contracts. The second thing is the blockchains initially didn't actually support some of the core primitives that were necessary for us to have, and that got hacked unnecessarily. If you don't give an easy way to do threshold signing on chain, so multiple keys actually owning smart contracts, then people are going to start writing multi-sig contracts. And multi-sig contract is, at the end of the day, a contract that is being written by a human. And so we saw what happened to Parity Wallet, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, when it got hacked. And that was the main smart contract that did multi-sig. So the security smart contract is the thing that ended up being hacked. It's kind of ridiculous that actually ended up being the case. What this should have been a core property of the blockchain itself, in a core system, in a core, tool that allowed people to have this type of thing. And yes, of course, look, we have to start somewhere and then we evolve, but that's the direction, is that the blockchain should take responsibility for a lot of the security primitives of the ecosystem that they haven't done before. They should take responsibility for better smart contract programming languages, and should take the responsibility for what's developer hygiene, how you do secure developer lifecycle, how do you update these smart contracts. A lot of those things are just kind of like thrown in the wind and then developers do on their own. And then they come up with all their solutions and the majority of them are terrible. No surprise there. And so we have to solve these problems at all these three layers: the smart contract programming language audit layer, the software development lifecycle, how we update them, and of course the blockchain itself, of the core primitives that have to be provided. They have to be higher level primitives. They're not just like basic, you build everything yourself, because that we see how that is ending. That is ending in tears.
Yeah, it's like spinning up your own crypto. Terminology clash. Sorry, people.
You shouldn't roll your own crypto. I mean, it works for both. Don't roll your own crypto. Works for both.
Exactly. That was a phrase for decades. Don't roll your own crypto, which means don't write your own cryptography algorithms, to put in blunt terms. Don't do it. use standards off the shelf that NIST in the US have approved, or someone else. So you don't roll your own cryptography. But here, what are your views on kind of the let's say ERC standards that have emerged and been battle tested? Because one of the things you just said is like, you know, people writing their own code and like it's a mess. But if you go and take some of these standards and then apply them in the correct way, you can mitigate a lot of really obvious vulnerabilities just by following the kind of patterns that have been set down, battle tested, and shown that they do survive in this highly adversarial software environment.
Fully agree. And in fact, what I think happens or should happen is a pipeline where you start experimenting with stuff. You see what works. When it works, you create frameworks around it and specific APIs. And the implementations of the APIs can be different. And by the way, the bugs, there's tons of bugs in ERC20s because you can't obviously screw up the implementation, but it still helps you like think through it and have like solid basis. And then you pull them in into the core libraries or a core set of smart contracts or even the blockchain itself. So I think there should be a pipeline for updating blockchains such that we do experimentation, we do standardization, and we do integration into the core blockchain itself for the things that are working. And that's not necessarily what's happening. And of course, some of the original blockchains like Bitcoin move very slow, and Ethereum is now moving faster. And there's, you know, post-Chapella upgrade with staking. That migration was humongous. That was a feat of distributed systems engineering, and sure, we were able to do it as an ecosystem. So there is clearly the possibility of progressing. It just needs to progress faster, and maybe like a lot more thought has to be done on how to integrate these core principles into the blockchain itself, such that if there's a vulnerability, we solve it at the whole ecosystem level, and we're not abandoning whoever used this particular smart contract, which is what caused the first fork of Ethereum. If you recall, it was the DAO hack, right? DAO. And so we both know how that happens and how much conflict it created, and so that's how we think about it.
There's one nice what economists call a positive externality from like all these problems and failures in the past. It's that people have learned from these mistakes and experienced them. This kind of cottage industry around smart contract auditing. I know this because it's part of my role here, which is to make sure that they audit the smart contracts correctly. That didn't used to exist, but I remember running into people from Trail of Bits, which is a company that does these audits out of New York City. They're all ex-cybersecurity people who got pulled into this about 7 years ago when this kind of market emerged. I mean, they are really pros, those kinds of people, and it didn't used to exist. But now that they've got this kind of got the demand, and then we've got all these lessons, the quality of smart contract development and deployment and auditing is just much, much better than it used to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. And by the way, we can call it pen testing. We've always had pen testing, and this is effectively like smart contract pen testing. I would say two things. I would say that you're absolutely right. The quality has increased at the top level. However, the demand is so large that the amount of people that are doing a crappy job has also increased proportionally. Sure. And so if you go to Trail of Bits, if you go to Bishop Fox, if you go all of these amazing people that actually do this, they're fantastic. And you have actual consummate professionals doing it. But at the lower tier, the lower end, you have people that just run like some automated thing, like, you know, sometimes happened in pen tests in the back, right? They run Nmap and then that would be it. Congratulations, I've just pen tested your company. And so the similar thing is happening with smart contracts. I mean, to that point, by the way, the majority of the smart contracts that are being hacked are audited. The large majority of them are audited. All of them right now are audited. There's no legitimate project that doesn't do it. And in fact, many of them are audited multiple times. And still, the complexity of the smart contracts is such that multiple, you know, not all eyes, you know, eyes make bugs shallow. And so it's just like, that's not necessarily true when the complexity is through the roof. So the reduction of complexity, the use of better programming languages, and the use of actually core blockchain primitives is definitely like one of the things that we need to help our auditors actually do a better job. And also the ability of having automated tools that do actual, provable smart contracts, or ability to actually construct payloads that are adversarial in an automated manner, so we can actually beef up the automated testing portion of smart contracts and not have as much manual work. So a smaller set of auditors can audit a way bigger set of smart contracts in a better fashion.
This is maybe, and I don't want to use buzzword bingo, it's where the natural language processing kind of trend starts intersecting, which is, on the one hand, it makes it easier to find the bugs to exploit or the vulnerabilities to exploit. On the other hand, it should mean that this limited workforce who are actually specialized enough to do this correctly are able to kind of produce more results with lesser inputs by using those same tools. Maybe that's just also, that is something that's different to 10 to 15 years ago when we started in cybersecurity. But that's maybe one element that can help.
Yeah, for sure. And it is moving really fast. I do think that the industry is not cohesive. And we're a ragtag of individuals, especially on the DeFi side of the world. And this decentralization ethos and the crypto anarchists to it makes people not really want to like even federate or loosely. And there needs to be good standards, and there are starting to be good standards around security and what you should follow. And I know, you know, Trail of Bits has actually put some out and has participated in some of these actually. So there's some good standards that are emerging. More of those things need to happen. There's a lot of SROs in the traditional financial world that actually have these standards. I mean, PCI Council, for what it's worth, exists, and it's kind of like, for all of the bad that it's done, is also done really good, right? And so it is what it is, but that's better than the current status quo in crypto, where we basically have nothing that people like stand behind. And so that will also help. So those types of mechanisms that we've learned from traditional financial industry can definitely help here, but we are a little bit looser organized and more cohesive. Industry would be much better.
Yeah, agreed. It's evolving quickly. And I mean, a lot of these standards, you know, they have trouble actually adapting and then being future-proofed. So it's a process. It's not new, though. I mean,
and it doesn't help that this industry moves so fast, so much faster than anything else that we've ever seen, right? The types of composition that it allows, and these things are built upon one another. So you haven't even tested the lower layers, and you're kind of like composing them in an abstract manner. And that's why we have so many of these issues of like, this thing breaks over here and that thing over there is broken. And then you have things like bridges and the complexity around layer ones and layer twos and how those things actually interact. And we know the security vulnerabilities are all on the APIs, on the API layer, on like the connectivity between this, or the majority of them are at least. And so if you increase by a factor of 100 the APIs, the level of points of connectivity, which is what we're doing with bridges and layer twos and layer ones, then all of a sudden you have like, I don't know, n square bugs, which you know, are n square vulnerabilities, which is sort of what you're seeing and what's happening.
Now it starts bringing complexity science stuff. But remember when OpenSSL got whacked a few years ago with Heartbleed, and you know, 60% of websites ran on it, or servers.
Yep.
I mean, my job previous to WisdomTree was as a cyber catastrophe lead for an insurance company, which was like, what one thing can we break in the internet that breaks everything? And we're in big trouble. I mean, in a way, you could start taking those same kind of concepts and applying it here in a similar way to what you just said. Well, if all the APIs aren't implemented correctly, then we have a X the N size problem. And then cleaning it up is a complete mess as well. So
it's also interesting that if you think about it from a distributed systems perspective, these blockchains don't have the same guarantees. So whenever you're trying to connect them, you're bound to find some like very esoteric vulnerability around timing or around the way that things are actually settled. Are they actually settled here or not settled here? And so it's like the differences, the impedance mismatch between these blockchains, and there's so many of them, actually compounds the problem, which is also pretty interesting.
Yeah. At some point, do you think that it kind of thins out, which is there's so many different networks competing on different dimensions, and then basically it's part of the survival of the fittest dynamic. Do we just kind of see the field converging, maybe not on one network?
Model is somewhere between programming languages and operating systems, which is there's lots of programming languages, and all of them are Turing complete. Technically, they all do the same thing. You know, they all do the same exact things. However, because some of them get popular with smart contracts in the case of Ethereum, and for example, web development frameworks on Ruby on Rails or what have you, then Ruby becomes very popular because the framework is very popular. Not because Python is not equally Turing complete. No, they're the same exact thing. Or why is C still around? Or why are people still using JavaScript, even though it was a crappy language? And so all of a sudden, like what you have is like proliferation of many programming languages, and all of them rise and fall based on the use cases and the applications that are on top of it and how developers move and what they're building and what new is happening in the world. So it's hard to control, but there's what, at least like 20, 30 like mainstream programming languages, at least, you know, a dozen that have, you know, hundreds of millions of people or tens of millions of people at least developing on them. And so that's one, that's the basis for me. The top line is operating systems. You have a lot less of them, but you still have lots of them, right? And they have different characteristics, and they technically also all do the same thing, but they have different application stacks, and they run different things, and they run on different hardware, and they do different things, and they have different focuses. One is privacy, one is whatever. And so all of a sudden you have that. I think blockchains will end up in between programming languages and operating systems in terms of use cases. So between not as many as programming languages, but not as few as operating systems.
Got it. That's a good mental model there. I'd love to go through like a standard wars, because I'm sure we could spend time on that. I see we are coming up on time though. We usually finish episodes by thinking about the future. You're doing lots of interesting things at Anchorage. Like, what are the things that you've got your eye on that you think the listeners who are trying to track this space should also be keeping an eye on as they evolve?
Well, the big ones that everybody is obviously keeping their eye on is the presidential election, because it affects the future of crypto quite a bit. But I think everybody has their eye on that one. The next thing is, again, we're still the only regulated bank, federal bank in the United States that does crypto. So we keep an eye out on the regulations. And we actually have a front seat to a lot of these regulations that we're helping shape and that we're actually meeting. So that's actually been pretty interesting. Everybody's keeping their eyes on the SEC potential approval of an ETF, which is pretty exciting. We're also keeping our eyes on what's coming out of these other regulators around, and especially of the Senate. So we can actually have some bills pass that, number one, hopefully get stable coins to have a steady regime, which is one of the most important things for crypto, is the stable coins need to succeed. And we should have legislation that actually, you know, creates clarity for them. And the second thing is, we still need to answer our age-old question of what are these things? Are they securities? Are they commodities? Are something different? And who regulates them? And so those bills are also pretty important. There's a couple of bills making it through, and that some of them are good. And even if they get shut down, remember that that language gets reused in the future. And so that's actually positive, the fact that they're debated and discussed in the first place. And there's a couple of bipartisan ones. So that's also pretty important. I do think that people should be keeping track of the hacks, as long as there are hacks. And this rate of DeFi hacks continues, and we don't actually have real solutions, not just ameliorated or kind of like ameliorating the problems, actually like real fundamental solutions. The space can't really be called mainstream and can't really attract the institutions like we keep clamoring that DeFi should be tracking. So that's definitely something for folks to keep an eye out on there.
It's funny that we must be at that point in the technology adoption curve and cycle where the things you've got your eye on are what's going to come out of Congress, what will come out of the courts, what will come out of different agencies. You know, if we were sitting in 1995 and we're talking about the internet, maybe 98, we might be talking about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, yeah, or the Clipper Chip or something.
That's right. Those are the equivalents. Here, obviously, like, our job is compounded by the fact that when we're talking about the internet, we're talking about software, and we were able to get like these free speech analogies for software that were actually pretty clear. But we weren't really entering money realm, and money has so many more detractors. And when the first cryptocurrency was a direct hit at the ability of central banks to control their monetary policy, we already like started it with on the wrong footing when it comes to actual regulation, right? And so we are coming like it's 10x harder here, just because there's entrenched interests from the current players in TradFi and obviously the governments. This is a technology that was made to decentralize and take away the centralized powers. And because a lot of people believe that the pendulum has swung to the other side, so by definition, we're going to have a lot more resistance. And so I feel like it's a lot harder for us than it was even then in the encryption wars and in the, you know, clipper chip wars.
The encryption wars. That's very nice of you to not call it the crypto wars, which is what it was called.
That's what it was called. But yeah, that ship was sailed. I have made my peace with it. Crypto means cryptocurrencies.
It's all of that stuff is just going to happen again. So I was chatting with someone the other day who's working on one of these layer twos, not on the show, so I won't say it was. But this person I used to run into in Washington, D.C. when I lived there 8 or 9 years ago. And he's a computer scientist, a professor, was working on cybersecurity, privacy, freedom of speech online topics. And here we go full circle. It's we're going to talk about the privacy of transactions on distributed databases and how you obfuscate them, Tornado Cash. We're going to talk about freedom of speech issues, sanctioning things like Tornado Cash, which is code. And we're going to talk about security stuff again, which is when things break, who's held responsible and liable for it. So, and then who commits the acts as well, which is Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the past, but this time around, I'm not sure like enough people are really being held accountable for committing crimes. But it's all full circle. It's just kind of uncanny in a way, just sitting where we are now and looking
back. The parallels are uncanny. That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just the latest iteration of new technology. So in that sense, it's not surprising. You could go back and look at issues around the telegraph or electricity. And
not only that, I think, not just the parallels, but the same issues are actually coming up again, right? Signal and all these backdoors that governments want to put into the messaging apps. It is the same conversation we were having before, which is, do we have the right to privacy or do we not have the right to privacy? It's a different backdoor. It's not Clipper. Clipper chip, but it's still something that is Clipper chip like, and so the same conversation is actually being had as internet is getting more popularity. And of course, if there's truly internet native money, then the risk for centralized entities and government just is compounded. So they care about it 10 times as much.
Yeah, that is something that is very and materially different when it's involving people's money. Well, they say money. People argue with me whether like crypto is money or what is it? Is it a security? Is it a commodity? Like, you'll argue about it, but point is it has value and it's information. We can't talk about the copyright wars, I'm afraid. We're at time, but hopefully in the future we'll be able to do another episode and touch on more of like nerding out geek history. Sign you up. All right, we will. Diogo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Twitter at Diogo Monica or for Anchorage, anchorage.com.
Cool. All right, folks, you know where to look. That's it. That's the end of the time, unfortunately. I hope everyone's found today's podcast useful and informative. US listeners, go to wisdomtreeprime.com. Check it out on the Apple or Android app stores. You can find me at Benjamin Dean. It has been an absolute pleasure chatting today. Diogo, thank you very much. I hope you have an excellent day.